This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm pleased to be talking with Tariq Ali, one of the leading intellectuals of our time. He does a little bit of everything, actually. He's an editor of New Left Review. He's written several great books, including Clash of Fundamentalisms and Pirates of the Caribbean. His latest is called The Duel, Pakistan on the Flight Path of American Power. But he's also a novelist and a filmmaker, and he's one of the screenwriters of Oliver Stone's new documentary, South of the Border, which is just out now. Tariq Ali, welcome back to Progressive Radio.
Very good to be with you, Matt.
Oh, the pleasure's all mine, really. Tell me how you got involved in this film.
Well, Oliver was interviewing me for a long series he's doing for Showtime called The Secret History of the United States. That, I think, is a 10-hour series. And he was doing a long interview with me on that. In fact, he interviewed me for about 6 hours. About a year ago, and then we talked about South America, and he said, "I've these guys, and I've made a film about them, about Chavez and the others, and would you have a look at it?" So I did. I mean, I looked at the rough cut, and there were a few problems, and we agreed there were problems.
What were some of the problems?
Well, the problems were there were too many talking heads. It was too academic. It was like a talk show on radio. I mean, not totally. I don't want to be, too harsh. But it was a bit like that. And so I looked at what they had. And the strength of the archive was Oliver interviewing 7 presidents. So I said, that's what you should play to, the strengths of the film, which are a well-known radical Hollywood director angered by what he sees on his own television screens about how Chavez is reported and Morales, and hops on a plane, sets up interviews these guys, and comes back and gives his report to his own people. And that's how we've done it. And I then wrote a commentary which went along with that. And that's all, really. It's not such a big deal. It's a modest film which tries to correct the views that exist in this country on these new leaders in South America, who are all left-leaning social democrats, really.
And did you end up going down and doing any re-interviewing of the leaders?
No, we didn't, because time was short. The film was already late. But they had enormous amounts of material already, Matt, and I was just surprised that it hadn't been used. So Rob Wilson, who's the producer on this, and who had been present at the interviews, told me, and reams and reams of stuff. So they cut a new version together very rapidly.
Now, you mentioned a couple times, Tariq Ali, that Oliver Stone was not happy with the mainstream corporate media coverage of what's been going down in Latin America, nor for that matter have I been. I mean, it seems to me that that coverage is astonishingly biased. The print coverage as well. I mean, the New York Times reporter Simon Romero can't say a kind word about any of these social democrats down there. Why, what's your assessment of the corporate coverage here in the United States, and why?
I think the corporate coverage, not just in the U.S., and if it was sort of Fox TV, one could almost laugh it off, though one shouldn't, but it wasn't. Most of the networks are on the same line, and as you mentioned, the New York Times' reporting of Venezuela has been appalling. They ended up backing the military coup to topple Chavez, i.e., getting rid of a democratically elected government. And then 2 days later, they had to change their minds and were embarrassed to do so. But they were forced to do so, saying they'd been too hasty. I mean, talking not like journalists, but like functionaries of the State Department. And the guy from the New York Times sent to interview Oliver and me about the film. It was like being interviewed by some high-ranking State Department official who wanted to know why this was in the film, why that was in the film, questioning everything. That's fine. I mean, they'll probably try and rubbish the film too, which wouldn't be a big surprise. But why they do it, Matt, that is a good question. I think it's really why they rubbish Chavez, because they think they've lost Venezuela. And not permanently, but they feel they've lost it, they can't control or influence it, and it's the largest oil-producing country in South America. So the fact that they've lost control of that country, even if temporarily, as they think, they don't like that. So they rubbish him, they try and topple him three times, they hope against hope something will happen to him, that this whole experiment will come to an end. And the media, which the corporate media, as you know better than me, is now an adjunct to power in this country and other countries. You know what really astonished me was not just the U.S. press, but the liberal press, by and large, in most of Europe, El País in Spain, Repubblica in Italy, published exactly the same sort of stuff. It could have been something being churned out by a secret Politburo of the empire somewhere, and all these people just covering it as the Washington wanted it covered.
I'm speaking with Tariq Ali. He is one of the screenwriters on Oliver Stone's brand new documentary, South of the Border. Tell me, Tariq, what these countries have been trying to do who've broken away from the Washington model.
Well, you know, if you look at the coverage in the U.S. media, the implication, and more than the implication, they state Chavez is a dictator. Now, this is a guy who's won 15 elections, all of which have been internationally monitored. The country which refuses to allow monitors to monitor their elections is Mexico, a close U.S. ally. One of these elections, a big important one, was actually monitored by Jimmy Carter and his foundation, and Jimmy Carter said that this is the fairest election I've ever seen. So he's a democratically elected leader. All these people, Morales in Bolivia, Correa in Ecuador, Lugo in Paraguay, the Kirchner, Cristina Kirchner, and they are all elected leaders, democratically elected. Now, what the hardcore Bolivarians like Chavez and Morales, and to a certain extent Correa, do is the exact opposite of what is done in the United States. They use the wealth of the state to bail out the poor, to build a free health service, have a free education system where the poor can actually go to universities free of charge.
Now, are the poor benefiting in those countries demonstrably?
They are benefiting. If they weren't benefiting, these guys wouldn't be being reelected, Matt. Hmm. And that is what people who rarely voted in elections are coming out to vote, because they feel they have a stake in these governments. In most parts of the Western world, when people get fed up, they remove the incumbent. They don't really, you know, most of the parties are virtually the same in what they do, corporate politics, that the incumbent is removed. It doesn't matter whether it's center-left or center-right. Then they're fed up, they just vote against whoever's in power. In these countries, they've been voting these leaders back into power time and time again, and that's a very interesting experiment, I think, in radical social democracy.
For a while there in Latin America, after Allende was overthrown by Pinochet, the sense was that this kind of experiment wouldn't be allowed by Washington. Why has that changed?
Well, Washington is not happy with it, but, you know, Allende they toppled because we were then living in the middle of the Cold War, and most of the dictatorships in South America supported Washington. And they could get away with it. It's difficult for them to get away with it now, even what they did in Honduras, getting rid of the elected leader. The Latin Americans were very unhappy with it. And at the last Latin American summit, they refused to pass a summit declaration with Obama present unless Cuba was, the embargo was lifted and Cuba was seated. So it's a very different mood now. So it's not as easy as for the U.S. to get rid of these governments. Too much is involved. It doesn't stop them. They, after all, did try and defeat Chavez, but his popular support was huge. And they didn't succeed. Also, they've been incredibly busy in the Middle East and Central Asia. So, you know, there's a limit to what they can do. I think militarily, there's no doubt in my mind that they are overstretched now. And even though they've got 7 bases in Colombia, the official terms are that this is for fighting the war on drugs inside Colombia. Well, so even legally, they're not allowed to go out. And were they to do so, it would unleash a civil war in the region. So I think it's difficult for them at the moment.
So in a way, the distracted or overextended empire in Iraq and Afghanistan has been a good thing for some Latin American countries.
Well, that's what they, you know, the Chavez would never say that. But he did tell me once that in Iraq, in the early days after the intervention when the resistance in Iraq was very strong, he said, Fidel Castro and I talk every night and we both got maps of the Middle East up and we watch where the resistance is attacking because, you know, they might not even know it, but they're really fighting for us as well.
I'm speaking with Tariq Ali. He is one of the editors of the New Left Review, a great left-wing magazine out of England. He's the author of Clash of Fundamentalisms and Pirates of the Caribbean. He's done something pretty interesting here for an intellectual. He's become a screenwriter of Oliver Stone's new documentary, which I'm dying to see, called South of the Border, and I've read some of the script of it. There was one line in the script, Tariq, that just jumped out at me, and this was Nestor Kirchner of Argentina relating a conversation he had with George W. Bush. Do you remember what Bush told him?
Just astonishing, isn't it?
Yeah.
What he said. I mean, when I first saw that footage, I jumped out of my skin. And Kirchner at the Mar del Plata summit, when he had a conversation with Bush, and he describes the conversation, you know, in a very calm way, and he says, Bush said to me that war is good for our economy. And Oliver Stone asks Kirchner, what? What are you, are you sure he said that? And Kirchner repeats very calmly, yeah, this is what the U.S. president said to me. Wars are good for the U.S. economy.
Well, that makes Bush out to be a military Keynesian, but he may not be wrong about that.
Well, he may not be wrong about that, you see, that it keeps the arms industry going. It's about the only industry, apart from IT industries, which are not in a good way, which the U.S. has going for it. I mean, all the other industries were more or less dismantled. So you have cars, and you have the military-industrial complex producing high-grade weapons technology and providing some employment. But, you know, it's an expensive way to do it, for God's sake. I mean, going and occupying other countries, killing people and losing your own people. And, of course, some people on the left have always said this, but to hear it from the lips of the U.S. president, as reported by the then-president of Argentina, is a bit disturbing.
An incredibly cynical line by George W. Bush, to be sure. And that's one reason among many to see this new film, South of the Border. You mentioned Obama a little bit and Honduras. The coup happened while Obama was in power. That was almost a year ago or about a little more than a year ago. And then the Obama administration's response to the Honduran coup was interesting. Obama himself did call it a coup within about 48 hours, but I don't think that word has passed the lips of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. What's your assessment of that?
Look, Matt, I think essentially what goes on, there's now a pattern to it that Obama uses emollient words, but the policy goes on just as before. In this article I did for the New Left Review, which you referred to, President of Kant, it's just a systematic pattern. It's a continuity with the previous administration, except in Afghanistan, Pakistan, where he's gone beyond them. Obama, in 1 year, has ordered more drone attacks in Pakistan than Bush did in his last 5 years in office, and these are killing civilians and creating hatred for the United States in that country. It's totally counterproductive. So it's sad because large numbers of young people were really enthused. I was here that year, and they voted for him. And, you know, many of them must be extremely disappointed.
Yeah, I want to point the listener, if you're listening to this show at your home, or if you can remember this title, if you're driving around in your car, the title of this article is called The Presidency of Kant, C-A-N-T, The Presidency of B.S., essentially, which my guest Tariq Ali wrote for the New Left Review a couple months ago. And in it, he says, there was no fundamental break in foreign policy as opposed to diplomatic mood music between Bush 1, Clinton and Bush II administrations. There's been none between the Bush and Obama regimes. And he talks in this article about the amnesiac element of the left here in the U.S. that wished otherwise. But maybe the scales are falling now. I don't know. What do you think?
I think the scales are beginning to fall now, Matt. And by the way, that essay which you refer to so kindly, I've now expanded it into a book, and it'll be out in the fall, which Verso are publishing.
What's the title of the book?
The Obama Syndrome, War Abroad, Surrender at Home.
Wow. Tell me what you think is happening now in Pakistan. You mentioned the drones and how they are causing the people, naturally, of Pakistan not to like the United States.
Well, it's not just Pakistan. Basically, you know, some of us argued years ago that if the war in Afghanistan is escalated and carries on, it's bound to destabilize Pakistan, which shares a long border with Afghanistan, and Pashtun people live on both sides of the border, so if they're suffering on one side, it has an effect on the other side. And that is exactly what's beginning to happen. And I'm not the only one who said that. Many people, you know, who were then close to or, you know, privately advising Obama said very similar things in public. But he went for it. He went for the surge, even though General Eikenberry, the U.S. ambassador in Kabul, said, we don't need more troops, but Petraeus and McChrystal convinced Obama to send more troops. Then, you know, not so long ago, McChrystal was dismissed and replaced by Petraeus as the commander in Afghanistan on exactly the same policies. And no one, I haven't yet read a serious article in the mainstream U.S. liberal media, New York Times, Washington, not going on about, you know, McChrystal's faux pas or what he said to Rolling Stone, which quite honestly is trivial stuff, but that what these bickerings at the top really reveal is despair at a war that is unwinnable. The generals know it can't be won, and they get angry with the politicians who then try and make life difficult for them, which is this why this hatred for Richard Holbrooke, Clinton's, one of her people in Kabul, who's ambassador to the region, because he tried to get rid of Hamid Karzai and the Afghan puppet president, and the generals know that if they don't have a point man in the region who they can get stuff from, it's going to make matters worse for them. They don't care he's corrupt. That doesn't surprise them.
But
so it's really they can't win the war. That's what's going on.
But you say the generals understand that, Tariq Ali, but it seems to me that General Petraeus, when he testified a month ago or so to Congress, he seemed to want to, you know, just blow right through that July of 2011 marker that Obama had put down as the start of a withdrawal. I've always been skeptical about that, but it doesn't sound like the generals want to obey that anyway. Not just McChrystal, but Petraeus himself.
I think you're probably right because, you know, where their careers are affected and some of these generals become incredibly vain and regard themselves as important figures in histories that yet have to be written. But if they don't get out soon, Matt, you know, this war is going to become more and more like Vietnam, not in the scale of it necessarily, but in terms of the U.S. getting bogged down. And I think Eikenberry, from some of the things he said, at least understands it. I mean, the real tragedy is that there is no serious exit strategy at the White House. They don't know how to get out. And as long as you don't know how to get out, you're then stuck with a military strategy which is unwinnable. I mean, Petraeus thinks he won in Iraq. You know, he boasted about the surge. And the boasting was that attacks on the U.S. are down to 15 a day. That was the big boast instead of 50 a day. But, you know, that doesn't seem to me as if that particular occupation and war has come to an end either. It came to an end for the media because they had to divert their attention to Afghanistan. But the Iraq business is very precarious, as many people in the White House know.
Though Obama himself essentially has declared victory there.
Well, it's, you know, another president, if you recall, also declared victory once. It isn't over.
I'm speaking with Tariq Ali. He is one of the screenwriters on Oliver Stone's new documentary, South of the Border. He's also the editor or one of the editors of New Left Review and has written tremendous books, including Clash of Fundamentalisms and Pirates of the Caribbean and The Duel about Pakistan. He's got a new book out about Obama. I wanted to follow up a little bit about Afghanistan here, Tariq, because in this article you wrote for the New Left Review that I mentioned earlier, The Presidency of Kant, you talked about the Vietnam comparison in Afghanistan, and while you said it's a quagmire, as Vietnam was, that it's unlikely that there's going to be a second Saigon, that it's unlikely that the United States is going to have to run at some fevered pace at some point and leave off a rooftop in a helicopter. Why not?
Well, because A, that the insurgency isn't strong enough, and B, the U.S. can't be defeated militarily. I mean, if you look at what happened in Vietnam, it was a combination of two things. The military defeat was there. They could no longer go on because their own army was beginning to crack up. I mean, GIs weren't fighting. Soldiers were shooting their officers. Retired GIs, wounded GIs were marching in the streets outside the Pentagon in Washington. There was a huge anti-war movement. They had just basically, they couldn't win. And the enemy of the United States in Vietnam was incredibly intelligent, incredibly courageous. And it became very clear. Now, these conditions do not prevail in Afghanistan. It is still at the level of a medium-range guerrilla war. There's no way in which the Afghans have the support of an outside power like the South Vietnamese did. They were backed by the North Vietnamese. They had a proper army. The Afghan insurgents, by and large, fight alone. The only army that would support them and has done so in the past, the Pakistani military, is not going to tangle with the United States. It's being paid billions of dollars a year precisely not to do that.
But there's still an assumption that maybe the Pakistani intelligence agency is still helping the Taliban in Afghanistan.
They probably are on a certain level, but look, we are now also in a situation where the U.S. has channels to the insurgents. They talk to them. Karzai, the president of Afghanistan, recently put in a request to Eikenberry asking him to remove the most wanted terrorist tag off the Taliban leadership so they could travel freely. Eikenberry's response was, well, I can't give a blanket amnesty, but let's do it case by case. Now, just think about this conversation, Matt. If we are already at this stage where the puppet leader in Afghanistan is thinking of negotiating with the Taliban and bringing them into his government, and the U.S. friend in Pakistan, Asif Zardari, is having secret meetings with the Taliban in that country, that means something's up, which we don't know. We don't have the full details, but I think there's no doubt in my mind that a lot of negotiating is going on behind the scenes.
Isn't it inevitable then, Tariq Ali, that the Taliban is going to join a government in Afghanistan at some point?
I think it is, and I think the only question is one of timing. So far, they have said they will not join a government and they cannot join a government as long as their country is occupied by foreign troops. The U.S. is trying to shift them on that and even rather crudely to divide them. This hasn't worked so far. I'm not saying it won't, but at the moment it seems unlikely because the population sees that they have a very weak government in that country. And the insurgents are getting stronger by the day. Their influence is growing.
What do you say to a listener who says, wow, we can't allow the Taliban to get back in government there? They are oppressed. They oppressed women so badly.
Well, I mean, you know, that is my own position is I've been very hostile to this Taliban for a long time. You know, they're not my political friends. On the other hand, the United States, by intervening in that country and by staying in it for over 9 years now, together with its European friends, I mean, you have 20 NATO and allied people in that 20 countries having troops there, including the Japanese and the Germans and the Ukrainians. You know, it's a list as long as my arm. And this has now made the Taliban more than ever it was before both a representative of the majority of the people in the South, and even in the West they have support inherent among Shias. And that astonished me, which means that the character of this group and this organization is changing. So when they join a government, a coalition government, I think what the Pakistanis say will matter a great deal. And in the last time, it was the Pakistanis who propelled the Taliban to power, and they were couldn't be bothered with anything else except just making sure they had Kabul. But this time now, I think they will ensure that there is no repeat performance of what happened the last time they were there.
I'm speaking with Tariq Ali. Tariq, can we go back to your film with Oliver Stone in the last few minutes that we have here? The film is a documentary. It's called South of the Border. What do you and Oliver Stone want the viewer to take away from this film?
Very simple. All we want the viewer to take away is that what we're being told on our media are basically lies, that they have not even attempted to cover Venezuela in particular, but also Bolivia and the other countries in that region fairly. And they are now trashing Lula for having tried to do what Obama once asked him to do, a deal with the Iranians on nuclear questions. So it will make them think, I hope, that not all that they see is true. This film bends the stick the other way in order to provide a mild corrective. Whether it will succeed, I don't know, Matt. I hope it does. But I think people who see it will be surprised. I mean, when Oliver was on the Bill Maher show the other day, Bill Maher said on screen, he said, you know, I was hostile to Chavez till I saw your film. I had no idea.
Well, I think that's the common interpretation. I mean, I remember seeing David Letterman mentioning Chavez's name and saying the guy's a crazy man. I doubt David Letterman has read, you know, 10 articles outside the corporate media, or 5, or 1.
I know.
So that's the image that prevails. And part of the script that I read, the painful, poignant thing that I was getting from the leaders themselves was all they wanted to do was to be treated equally. Or to be respected, and not just treated like they have to go marching with whatever order comes down from Washington.
That's right. It's essentially, apart from social reforms and social justice measures that they're pushing through, it is a movement for independence, a movement for independence from the United States.
And it's also a movement for indigenous rights. There's a line in the script that Evo Morales of Bolivia looks like a Bolivian.
He does, and 70% of that country is indigenous. The native people there were not wiped out, and they lived in appalling conditions. And you know, just so to see their faces now, when I was in Cochabamba a few years ago, they were happy. And you know, even in the old market towns, the women were saying to me, "Buy a hat like this. Why don't you buy it from us? Evo wears one." And you know, a real pride. I mean, Evo Morales is the Nelson Mandela of Bolivia. That's how they look at him. That at long last, since our country was founded over 200 years ago, we have got a Bolivian native indigenous person as our elected leader. He really is loved.
I mean, that's what Lincoln used to say. We should be a government of, by, and for the people. Imagine that. Anyway, the movie is called, the documentary, South of the Border by Oliver Stone, and one of the screenwriters has been my guest today, Tariq Ali. Tariq, thanks so much for being my guest.
Very good to be with you, Matt.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.